I'm calling Leslie. Isn't that amazing? That's pretty cool.
Good morning, everyone. We're going to go ahead and open up the Senate Committee on Judiciary. And we're going to start off with a work session that we carried over from yesterday. We're waiting to get the fiscal. So, Council Taylor.
Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 522 comes to you from Senator Starr. You may remember this bill yesterday. We had the dash one and dash two amendments. We now have the fiscals for both amendments. It authorizes a court to terminate parental rights convicted of parents been convicted of rape. The dash one amendments made an exception where it was consensual but statutory. And then the dash two amendments do not relieve the parent of the obligation to pay child support.
All right, just to be formal, since I said we were going to start off with the work session, we're actually opening up the work session on Senate Bill 522. And the chair will take a motion on the, I think at this point, for the passage of 522 as amended.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 522 as amended with the dash one and twos. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, you adopted the amendment
three.
Yesterday.
The dash three is now.
What
okay.
is the dash three, though?
They are the ones and twos
okay.
combined.
Okay.
And let me just say that Felissa Seidlick was listening yesterday, and she was putting the ones and twos together as we were speaking.
So how would you like just the dash three?
We already have adopted
okay.
the ones and twos.
Okay. Okay, so I move Senate Bill 522 as previously amended with the dash one and dash twos to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
All right, here we go. Senator Dingfelder moves the Senate Bill 522 as amended by the dash ones and dash twos, which actually could be considered the dash threes, to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. And let's see, that one there.
I think he was by Senator Starr.
That one goes, yeah. Senator Starr said that's his bill, so he'll be the carrier on that one. Thank you. We'll close that work session. All right, now we're going to start our public hearings. What I'm going to do is I'm going to start at the top of the list, and we're going to work our way down. We may need to move 392 to the end of the agenda, but we'll wait and see if I have everyone here that needs to be here that had requested to be giving testimony. With that, we'll start off with Senate Bill 389. So I'm opening up the public hearing on Senate Bill 389.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 389 establishes a uniform process to obtain confidential jury records for use as evidence in post-conviction relief proceedings. It specifies pleading requirements, permits the court to release records based upon certain findings, grants trial court administrator and state court administrator rights to intervene, declares an emergency, is effective on passage. There is also a dash one amendment, requires the request for records be made in post-conviction relief petition or on motion during proceedings, requires filing of request no later than 90 days before post-conviction relief hearing, absent good cause to file within a shorter time, clarifies the standard to release the records as likely to produce evidence relevant to a claim of substantial denial of constitutional rights.
All right, so I have Bruce Miller that's scheduled to give testimony. Bruce, come on up. Will there be anyone who'd like to give testimony on 389 besides Bruce? All right, Bruce, after you give your testimony, stay put, because I've got the other two bills with you as the only ones that signed up to testify. So if you'll give us the testimony on 389.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Bruce Miller. I'm senior staff counsel in the Office for the State Court Administrator. The counsel has given you the description of the bill. Here's why we need it. Currently, requests for jury records at the criminal and civil trial level is covered by ORS 10.275. That sets forth an orderly process for requesting confidential jury records. It does not include proceedings at the post-conviction relief level. So the purpose of this bill is to put into place a procedure for parties to follow at the post-conviction relief level. It mirrors what's in ORS 275. This will end some of the confusion that we're beginning to see both on the parts of parties and on the part of the courts as to how to process these. The petitioner will not have any greater or lesser rights than the petitioner would have had to the juror records in the underlying criminal case. The dash one amendments we sought at the request of OCDLA, the bill as drafted required the request to come in the petition. Often these petitions are filed by an inmate without counsel. Later counsel is brought into the case. The defense attorneys were concerned that they wouldn't have an opportunity to seek these records if the inmate had not pled the request in the petition. This allows them to bring a motion. The motion has to be brought at least 90 days before the hearing to give everyone adequate time to respond. And we worked with them on that. They think the amendments are fine, and so do we. Thank you for giving me the time.
Thank you. Questions for Bruce on Senate Bill 389 or the dash ones? Not seeing any. Chair would, let's see. Okay, I guess I need to just ask this. Is there anyone else who wants to give testimony again on Senate Bill 389? All right. At this point, I think what we're going to go ahead and do is just close this out because it's only for public hearing, so we can't even deal with the dash ones. So we'll close that public hearing. We'll open up public hearing on Senate Bill 390.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 390 limits disclosure of record of commitment proceedings to parties while pending and on appeal, requires appellate court to protect the identity of the subject of the proceedings, and conforms disclosures to comply with federal law. Also authorizes the Chief Justice of the Oregon Supreme Court to determine the effective date for Sections 2 and 4, declares an emergency effective on passage.
All right, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Bruce Miller. I'm Senior Staff Counsel in the Office for the State Court Administrator. We brought this bill forward to help restructure these statutes so that they work better in the electronic environment. As we moved to e-court, we saw that there were some statutory adjustments needed to make this process work properly in the electronic environment. It doesn't change any of the protections that are already available in statute. This is for civil commitment proceedings, both for persons alleged to have mental illness, which is in one ORS chapter, and mental retardation, which is in another ORS chapter. The bill does the following. It clarifies that the parties and their lawyers have access to the case records while the case is pending and after judgment. It specifies that limitations on disclosure at the trial court level also apply at the appellate court while the record is in the appellate court's custody. It requires the appellate courts to use naming conventions and publishing opinions to protect the identity of the person subject to the proceeding, and it updates some section in the 2009 Oregon laws and two other statutes regarding information that we will be required in the future to send on to the state police to comply with federal law.
All right. Questions for Bruce on Senate Bill 390? Not seeing any. I'll go ahead and close the public hearing on Senate Bill 390. Open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 391.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 391 allows tax court magistrates to hold other for-profit positions under certain conditions. It takes effect on the 91st day following adjournment. Sine die.
Bruce.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Bruce Miller. I'm Senior Staff Counsel in the Office for the State Court Administrator. ORS 305.498 currently prohibits a tax court magistrate from engaging in any kind of outside employment for pay. It's an unusual statute that way. The restriction goes beyond the existing restrictions on judges and other judicial department employees. The registration makes it difficult for us to recruit and retain part-time magistrates because obviously they can't have any other employment if they have the magistrate position. In fact, we had a magistrate who had an opportunity to coach her daughter's gymnastics team for pay, and she had to decline that opportunity because of this statute. The statutory amendment proposed by the bill would allow a magistrate to seek additional employment if the second position does not create a conflict of interest. Any outside employment would still be subject to restrictions of the Oregon Judicial Department personnel rules, which prohibit employees from engaging in the private practice of law or in employment that would raise a conflict of interest. It's subject to the Oregon Constitution, Article 3, Section 1, which prohibits employees of one branch of government from working for another. It's guided by the Oregon Code of Judicial Conduct, which covers conflicts of interest, and the Oregon Government Ethics Commission, which also covers conflicts of interest. So those are the protections in place to watch over the magistrates and what they can and can't do for employment. Thank you for giving me the time to speak to the bill.
All right. Any discussion, Senator Cruz?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Would this allow them, for example, to take a teaching position and teach courses related to law. I'm assuming that wouldn't be a conflict, would it?
It is.
Because we dealt with that, or tried to.
We've tried twice, and we're trying a third
okay,
time.
Okay. So that would be covered under...
Yeah, the SJR, for those who are listening, there's a prohibition now on judges really doing anything in the way of on the education arena.
Right.
This bill that we, or the resolution we have now, actually would be more expansive, not only allowing a judge to teach in a public law school or any other school, technically, they'd also be able to have a JAG position, if I'm not mistaken.
I believe that's true, Mr. Chair. That was a problem I think Judge Rasmussen identified in the interim. And
right, as another, I think there's potentially another judge that has, that's a military reserve and cannot serve in the JAG because of their conflict of being sitting as a judge.
Okay.
So that's something else working with the President's office.
Okay. But however, in the case, because the judge can now serve those functions in a private school, I believe.
Correct.
So this would allow that, for example, at Willamette or Lewis and Clark or some other private institution.
Mr. Chair, Senator Cruz, that's correct. Because
okay.
The problem on the teaching is if it's a public school, you're an executive
right.
branch,
right.
private school, then
right.
you don't have that problem.
Right. Thank you. Okay.
Senator Wissett.
Thank you, Chair Brzezinski. Mr. Miller, have you done a legislative search as far as why the current statute is written the way that it is? What was the thinking of the legislature in setting that standard?
Mr. Chair, Senator Whitsitt, I tried to find out. I couldn't find anything very useful there. The tax magistrates were part of the move to take some of this process out of Department of Revenue some time ago and put it into the tax court. And beyond that, I'm not sure how this got written the way it did. It's there's nothing like this, for instance, for the administrative law judges. There's certainly nothing like this for elected and appointed judges. So I honestly can't tell you why it was put in there.
Thank you.
All right. Any other questions or comments? All right. Thank you, Bruce.
And
I'm good. Well, I'll just ask on this one here. Does anyone else want to give testimony today on Senate Bill 391? Not seeing anybody, we'll close that public hearing. And what I'm going to do now is open up our the next public hearing. Instead of being 392, I have an individual who had to be in a different hearing. They requested that we, if we could put this to the bottom, if they weren't able to be here at the time, I'm going to go ahead and honor that. And so we'll start with our next one will be a public hearing on Senate Bill 397.
Senate Bill 397 allows action based on tort to be brought against officer, employee, or agent of a public body if the complaint alleges that the plaintiff is entitled to damages in excess of the Oregon Tort Claims Act limits. There is a -1 amendment that limits total combined recovery to a single occurrence. At common law, a person has the right to sue over another individual in tort, but no right to sue a public entity. The Oregon Tort Claims Act, OTCA, provides a limited statutory right of recovery against public entities and indemnification rights for its officers, employees, and agents. Functionally, this means that when a lawsuit is brought naming individual employees of a public body is substituted as the sole defendant and recovery against the public body is capped. In 2007, the recovery against public entities was limited to $200,000. A substitution occurred as described in the case of Clark versus OHSU, which pleaded combined damages in excess of $15 million, I believe. The Oregon Supreme Court held that the plaintiff was denied an adequate remedy as required by the Remedies Clause of the Oregon Constitution as to the public body substituted for individual employees because at common law plaintiff's recovery against such employees had no cap. The recovery against the public body itself was not unconstitutional since that claim was entirely a creature of statute under the OTCA and could therefore be capped by the legislature. Legislature responded to the court's decision in Clark in 2009 with Senate Bill 311. Tort recovery limits were raised to $1.6 million per individual and $3.2 million per occurrence, and as against local government recovery limits were raised to $533,000 per individual and $1,066,700 per occurrence. Senate Bill 397 brings further refinement of the legislature's attempt to respond to the Clark case.
All right, thank you. And we have at the table Roy Pulvers and Amy Wasson.
Wason,
excuse me. And who's going to start?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Amy Wace, and I'm Vice President and General Counsel at Oregon Health and Science University. And I appear today to testify on behalf of OHSU in support of Senate Bill 397 with the Dash 1 amendment. Senate Bill 397 amends the Oregon Tort Claims Act to allow a person with a claim against a public body to bring and maintain that action against an individual officer, employer, or agent of that body if the damages alleged in the claim exceed the current caps that appear in the Oregon Tort Claims Act. This would be a change from the current law, which provides in what is referred to as the substitution provision, that a public body is substituted as, or on proper motion, is substituted as the sole defendant in such claims. And what Senate Bill 397 would do would be provide basically work that the substitution provision would no longer apply in such cases where the damages alleged exceed the cap. The logical place to go right this minute would be why to do that, but just let me stop for a pause for a minute and remark on what Senate Bill 397 does not do. What it doesn't do is, notwithstanding the naming of individual defendants, it does not change the statutory obligation of the public body to pay for any damages awarded to a claimant. So there is a statutory obligation by the public body to defend and indemnify its agents and employees, and that would remain in place notwithstanding the naming of individual defendants. What Senate Bill 397 does not do is change the total amount of damages for which the public body may be liable. This is particularly clarified in the Dash 1 amendment. But to state that differently, regardless of the number of defendants named in cases, if it's the public body plus any number of individual defendants, there would still be a single per occurrence and per claim cap that would apply. So one might ask, why do you make this change if you're not altering who is paying for any exposure and the amount of the damages? And the answer is, to state it simply, is to further respond to some concerns that were articulated by the Oregon Supreme Court in the Clark decision. And those concerns focus on the fact that the substitution provision that I referred to earlier operates to completely eliminate a claim against an individual defendant rather than simply limiting a claim that may be brought against an individual defendant. You'll recall that when Clark came down in 2007, there was a piece of time, and the 2009 legislature responded to what was called out very explicitly in the Clark decision, and that was concerns about that the court had about the great disparity in the amount of the damages in that case. It was a very high damages case, and the then Oregon Tort Claims Act caps, which were quite low. And the 2009 legislature, appropriately in my view, substantially raised the cap to initially a $1.5 and a $3 million per claim per occurrence cap, and built in an escalator that increases that cap over time. As we've studied the Clark decision, we've noted that in addition to that emphasis on the disparity in the damages to the cap, the court expressed the concerns about this elimination of the right to sue the individual, and 397 is intended to respond to those concerns. Just one final comment before I close, and that is to note that as we've looked at 397 and this change, we have concluded that it will impact quite a small number of cases of those brought against public body for a couple of reasons. One is that it only pertains to cases that assert damages above the Oregon Tort Claims Act caps, and by far the majority of cases are well below those caps. Secondly, public bodies, and certainly OHS, use experience. We settle the vast number of claims. I think last year we tried one case, so that by far the vast number of claims get settled, so that there's not a circumstance where any judgment would be entered against an individual. We settle in the name of the public bodies, and the individuals are not a party to that. And finally, our experience in the employment setting and talking with other public lawyers, the experience certainly in at least the social services setting, and there are other settings as well, is that individuals are currently being named in lawsuits in those instances, and it happens with a lot of frequency, where claimants are alleging civil rights theories or other federally based theories, so that the Oregon substitution provision doesn't operate to eliminate the individuals as defendants in those cases. And given, so in conclusion, I'll make the comment that given the relatively small impact of this and the potential significance to further respond to the Supreme Court's concerns articulated in Clark, and given the importance of the Oregon Tort Claims Act caps in preserving public resources for all public bodies, we urge passage of the legislation. I'm happy to respond to questions. I will note that with me is Roy Pulvers. Roy is a very highly regarded appellate lawyer, former counsel to the Oregon Supreme Court, who's currently in private practice, and he's much more conversant, frankly, than I am on the nuances of the Supreme Court's thinking, and can provide some further insight there. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Roy?
Thank you. Members of the committee, my name is Roy Pulvers. I'm a partner in the law firm of Hinshaw & Culbertson LLP in Portland, and I appear on behalf of Oregon Health & Science University today to testify in support of Senate Bill 397 with the -1 amendment, and I appreciate very much the opportunity to testify before you today. The purpose of this bill is twofold, and I want to preface that by mentioning one other thing that this bill does not do, and it doesn't affect, as Ms. Wason mentioned, the vast range of cases where the allegations are below the cap. In those cases, the statute would still provide that the sole cause of action is against the government entity, and on appropriate motion, if an individual is named, they can be substituted out and the government entity substituted in. And of course, that raises no potential constitutional concerns, because if the allegations are below the cap limits, then plaintiff isn't seeking a remedy above the cap. So the vast range of cases are not affected by this at all. The purpose of the bill is twofold, and the first is to conform the statutes under the Tort Claims Act to the apparent practice in the courts in the wake of the Clark decision. That is, in cases where there are allegations of damages above the cap, and if a judgment is entered in an amount above the cap and the court is concerned about the constitutional validity of the cap, the court will, as it was the case in the Ackerman case against OHSU, hold the individual named and liable for the amount of the judgment above the cap. And that is, of course, because the government is entitled to limit its own liability to the cap amounts, and there needs to be somebody held liable for amounts above the cap if the court concludes that the cap is not adequate. So under current practice, in the Ackerman case, for example, under the old cap, individuals are being named and held liable when damages exceed the cap amount, at least in that instance. And reasonably enough, one could understand in the wake of Clark and Ackerman a court's reluctance to let individuals out in cases that allege damages well in excess of the cap. The other purpose is to address the constitutional concern articulated by the court in Clark that the so-called substitution amendments that the legislature adopted in 1991 have created a situation where the asserted historic right of an individual to sue the individual who is alleged to have caused the harm was completely eliminated in 1991 when the legislature change the law to make the sole cause of action against the government and to provide that if an individual is named, they can be, on appropriate motion, substituted out and the government substituted in. One of the many places where the court addresses this in Clark, the court says, with the 1991 amendment to the Tort Claims Act, the legislature eliminated a plaintiff's right to seek a full recovery for torts committed by public officers, employees, or agents. That amendment left any injured person in those circumstances with a capped remedy of $100,000 in economic damages and $100,000 in non-economic damages against the public body only. The statute also eliminates entirely any claim against the individual tortfeasors by requiring substitution of those individual defendants by the public body as the sole defendant. That thought, which is summarized in that paragraph from Clark, is reiterated multiple times through the opinion. And the purpose of this amendment is to, in effect, restore the law to the situation prior to the 1991 amendments under the Oregon Tort Claims Act, in which the individual had the right to sue both the entity and named individuals. The total amount of damages was capped by the single cap, and the sole cause of action was not simply against the entity, but against the individual. So the purpose of this law is to return the world to where it was prior to the 1991 amendments that appear to have caused the court concern in Clark. Final point, I guess, is that in addition to addressing the court's concern, it bears note that Article 1, Section 10 is intended to provide the legislature with a significant role in the iterative process on the remedies clause. This is not the court laying down the law and saying this is how it has to be. The remedies clause anticipates, and the court in Clark expressly recognizes, that the legislature has an important role to play. And in the course of adopting the 2009 legislation, Senate Bill 311, the legislature undertook a major response to the court's concerns in Clark, and this would be another piece of that, trying to respond to the court's an articulated legal concern of the court in Clark. Thank you.
Questions, comments? Senator Wissett first.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm certainly not an attorney and not a learned attorney, but it certainly appears to me that we're creating a remedy here that's not a remedy. At the top of page 2 of the bill, as I read it, explicitly says that the cap stays the same, even though it's on the employee. You really think the Supreme Court's going to buy that?
Well, Mr. Chair and Senator Whitsitt, I wouldn't presume to predict, I simply wouldn't presume to do that. What I can say is that a close and fair reading of the Clark decision makes it clear that the court sees a difference, a constitutional difference, between complete elimination of a remedy and the legislature's right to modify a remedy and cap a remedy. And so this is responsive to that articulated concern. Will it ultimately make a difference? We don't know. There's no way to predict that. What we can say is that it clearly was a manifest concern of the court and Clark, and that this is responsive to it, and that the legislature ideally its role is to, under Article 1, Section 10, it is to be responsive in that dialogue and to create the condition where the court has the best opportunity to consider the cap under the Constitution and make a full decision.
Thank you. Second question has to do with the need for insurance of a public employee. If it's a, your doctor's had another problem that it greatly exceeded the cap, if the court decides that this remedy that's really not a remedy isn't going to fly, then does that leave the employee liable for the balance of that effort? And how would the under what under what scenario would the state actually pick up the difference since the state has a cap?
Mr. Chair, Senator Witzel, permit me to answer that question. There is a statute that requires that public bodies defend and indemnify their employees and agents for acts, for liability that incurs within the course and scope of their employment. So a public body wouldn't be permitted not to pay it. And OHSU actually had the experience in the Ackerman case where a verdict was in, was entered on, against OH and a capped amount against OHSU in a capped amount against our medical group, which was a separate 501c3 at the time, and then the balance was a judgment entered against the individual. And pursuant to that statutory mandate, OHSU paid all of those amounts as was appropriate under the statute. And that would remain true with the passage of 397.
So the statute that you were using supersedes the Oregon Tort Liability cap? So they're you're
it goes hand in hand, and the statute that I refer to is not. It doesn't say the public body has to pay to the limits of the cap. It says the public body has to pay. Mm-hmm. Period.
Okay. So functionally, we've eliminated the cap.
I'm sorry.
So functionally, we've eliminated the cap. If the court doesn't buy this argument, the state is still liable to pay the employees. Award against the employee up to whatever it is, so that we've eliminated the cap if the court doesn't buy the exit. Okay, thank you.
Okay, I think for the record, I want to get clarification. With the cap, the public entity would be, and if, let's say there was a judgment that was awarded against the entity and it went to the cap level. That would be the first part of the judgment and then the sense of for the public entity. If the court deemed that the employee should be on the hook for additional amounts that would be above and beyond the cap, then that would be a judgment entered against the employee. But because of the other statute, the public entity that the public employee is employed by would actually be required to indemnify. So the judgment would still show that the judgment was against the public employee, but in reality, the public entity would be the one that would actually pay that additional amount.
Mr. Chair, that's 100% correct.
No, well, excuse me.
Roy, I was going to say, don't go too fast. The council over here is going to clarify. I just want to make sure
Mr. Chair, I think that's almost entirely correct. I think that for the first, let's say $1.6 million in a single cap case, if there were two defendants, Dr. X and OHSU, the first $1.5 million, if both were sued and both named, depending on what the jury's verdict says, might well be that the doctor and OHSU were jointly and severally liable, potentially, for the amount up to the 1.5, not just the entity, but the doctor and the entity jointly and severally, and then the individual above the 1.5. As a practical matter, as Senator Whitsitt has recognized, OHSU writes the check for the entire amount.
Correct. Okay. Questions, comments?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I knew you would.
Just for clarification, I know that you're here speaking on behalf of OHSU, and I looked at the sign-up list, and I didn't see any affected employees signing up to testify, so I wonder if you know what their position is.
We've had a series of conversations, Roy and I have, with the I should start by saying, Mr. Chair, Senator Bonamici, we've had a series of conversations with public counsel who have worried out loud, frankly, with us about the significance to their employees. We personally haven't had conversations with public employees, so I can't represent what a position is. But I will say that as we've had those discussions, both OHSU had some examination to do about what is the impact of this to our providers and our other employees, and then we've heard the same concerns articulated by other public counsel, and our experience has been that that in the course of the discussions we've seen a recognition that that is similar to those we came to. One is that this isn't going to be very impactful because of the very small number of cases affected. People are getting named individually now. Yes, there will be isolated instances where, as the chair pointed out, a judgment could be entered against an individual. The public body still pays. But I guess we, having listened to some of the individuals in our community and other public lawyers having listened to the concerns in theirs, have reached a conclusion that that this is not a kind of a material impact on the individuals.
Thank you.
Senator Cruz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If we don't do this, somebody seeks remedy above the cap, what currently happens?
Under Senator, Mr. Chair, Senator Cruz, regardless of whether Senate Bill 397 is passed, under Senate Bill 311, in the next case or in any case in which there is a legal issue raised in the trial court with respect to the validity or the applicability of the cap, and the amount of damages is finally determined at the trial court level, Senate Bill 311 provides for a direct appeal from that trial court decision to the Oregon Supreme Court. And that would be the case whether Senate Bill 397 passes or does not pass.
We'll have a test case at some point, won't we?
Well, I think that's it. And I guess for the record, my understanding why we have 397 is based on, let's say, a review of what we were doing with 311. There's this potential area that we want to, let's say, close the gap so we don't see, and from my perspective, the caps being thrown out because it doesn't have the remedy that will be provided under 397 because of how the law has been interpreted prior to 1991, if I remember correctly.
That's correct.
Or up to 1991. So, other questions, comments?
Mr. Chair, so to a degree, what we're trying to create is a way to keep the cap in place and then allow people to go above it. So how does that make it a real cap?
Well, the cap is still in place. What we're doing is we're ensuring what was the right of an individual plaintiff to be able to seek the redress as provided for under the Oregon, I'm going to say, Constitution, up through 1991 when we start seeing some modifications and changes. So at this point, the reading that Ms. Pulvers has given us, and I think other legal scholars would say, by not having this, you do, in fact, put the cap in a situation of where the court could have another decision that says that because this remedy was taken away, then the cap would not be able to stand. And where we've already had the statute of indemnification of a public employee, you can say, yeah, well, that gives you the ability to go above and beyond the cap. And I would say, yes, the realization would be, yes, the payment would be above and beyond, but I don't think it actually circumvents the cap. Any other questions, comments? All right, thank you very much for coming forward.
Thank you.
We have two other people who are scheduled to give testimony on 397, David Solomon and John Potter. Thank you for being here. Whoever would like to start, you just identify yourself, please.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is John Potter. I work as the Assistant Director of Operations for the Parks and Recreation Department. With me is David Solomon, who is the Safety and Risk Manager for the Parks and Recreation Department. And we are here today to comment on related Senate Bill 311, which was passed in, as was mentioned, in the 2009 legislative session, and in particular how our department has implemented that legislation. and Mr. Solomon will discuss the some of the specifics, the background and specifics as it relates to parks, and we'd be happy to answer any questions that you have following that.
All right, thank you. Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is David Solomon. I'm the Safety and Risk Manager for Oregon State Oregon Parks and Recreation Department. As we've heard, Senate Bill 311 increased the tort claim limits in the Oregon Tort Claims Act, ORS 30.271 and 30.273. And this translated to an increased risk for state agencies, such as state parks, for losses from liability claims. For state parks, those potential exposures come in three main forms. We engage in contracts with vendors, construction contractors, other entities, public and private. We issue permissions to certain users of state parks, and we also enter into contracts and sponsorship agreements related to the Oregon State Fair and Exposition Center. Now, in light of the increased tort claim limits from the Senate Bill 311, the agency began to implement higher insurance requirements for these contracts and agreements. And in doing so, we found that many of our vendors, contractors, and private citizens, nonprofit groups who were permit applicants found that these increased insurance requirements were a significant challenge. Some of these parties were flat-out unable to obtain insurance at the higher levels based on the types of activities they were engaged in. And those that were able to attain additional coverage experienced at times significant financial hardship. The cost of insurance just became a lot more expensive for them. In routine state parks and state fair business, we engage, or the parties that we work with engage in a variety of low-risk activities that we typically do not require substantial liability insurance for. Some examples would be, if you've been to the state fair, you see a lot of product exhibitors and product vendors there. We engage in agreements with a variety of consultants that provide services, design services, for example, for Oregon State Parks interpretive displays. And then there are a host of minor construction contracts that we enter into. Going forward, we found that these insurance requirements were at times insurmountable for our citizens and private nonprofit groups, volunteer groups, that were seeking to engage in non-traditional park activities that required a permit. Some examples of that would be, you've probably been to some of these or participated in them, Civil War reenactments, running events, biathlons, triathlons, a wide variety of different types of fundraisers that occur on state park property, large public gatherings, weddings, scouting events, church baptisms, and more recently, one of the most recent ones that we looked at was an equestrian competition at Stubbs Stewart State Park. Many of these groups found the higher insurance coverage just to be unaffordable, and they were faced with coming up with additional funding or, in the case of fundraisers, giving up some of the proceeds just to pay for insurance, or potentially canceling some long-standing events that take place on park property. For example, the Civil War reenactments have been going on in state parks for a long time. In response to this situation, the agency developed a policy to ensure that the state is protected to the extent possible from risk of loss through indemnification and insurance. To address the issues that arose, we developed a procedure to evaluate the risk of these various activities, determine what the appropriate insurance requirements would be based on the level of risk and loss history, industry standard, et cetera. And it provided a mechanism for us to reduce those insurance requirements when it made sense to do so based on the risk. The risk assessment is conducted by frontline staff or park managers. If the risk assessment reveals that the activities are low risk and it just makes good business sense to reduce the insurance requirements, then that insurance request funnels up through the chain of command. It's reviewed by, approved by a frontline manager. That person's upline manager. It comes to me as the safety and risk manager. And if, based on the evaluation, the potential for risk in the reduction is greater than I am comfortable approving, then it would go to an assistant director or possibly even the director. In using that process that was implemented in May of 2010, we've processed a total of 109 insurance reduction requests. Of those 109, just a quick summary, 63 were for State Fair sponsorship agreements, and 46 were special use permits under our Division 16 rule for non-traditional park activities. Of those 109 requests, only two specific types of requests have not been approved for insurance reduction. Those were timber sport and dirt track events at Oregon State Fair, again based on the risk, and public fireworks displays at several state parks. And I might say that even though those requested insurance reductions were not granted, in all of those cases, those parties were able to go back to their insurers and find the insurance up to the tort claim limits. So those events still took place. It just required additional insurance for those parties. To date, there have been no liability issues from events where we have granted insurance reductions. So I'd say the early indicators are that our risk assessment process has been effective and allows us a method to continue to allow those longstanding traditions and to work to protect risk for state parks and reduce liability for the state. Thank you, and we'd be happy to entertain questions.
All right, thank you. Questions? Comments. I want to thank you for coming forward. What I wanted to do, just for the committee notes, I wanted to have someone from one of the agencies showing how this is being played out. The chair believes and the intent of 311 was not to require every entity to be paying the amount that would be the cap or at the top, but instead, as I hear what the park's doing, is looking at the risk of what the activity is and then requiring insurance to that level. And I'm hoping by my statements that others will see and hear through public government that that's the way it was intended to be done, not to require the max under the cap, but instead it should be based on the risk and you should require the insurance for that that amount. We're going to continue to work on this issue to make sure we have clarity. It may not be through 397, it may be through some additional work during the interim, but gentlemen, thank you very much for coming forward.
Thank you.
Thank you. I'm just going to warn parks that we're going to take some of their money for marine reserves, but that's a whole other issue.
Different day, different committee. Thank you very much. All right, so was there anyone else who wanted to give testimony on 397? Not anyone. I'm going to close that public hearing. Before we start our last public hearing, the chair moves to reconsider the vote that we took on Senate Bill 522. So I'm going to reopen the work session and make that motion again. Does anyone have any objection to reconsider the vote that we passed Senate Bill 522 as amended to the floor?
Is this so Senator Cruz can vote?
Yeah.
Have a good reason.
I need to think about that.
Okay, no. So I don't think there's any. I got the comments, but I didn't think there's any objection. So it's official. You're part of the other four.
Thank you, and I vote aye. So
we got an aye vote. Okay, we'll close that work session on 522. Now we're opening up our last public hearing on Senate Bill 392.
Mr. Chair, did you tell him he's carrying it, though?
Starred. Already got this one, yeah.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 392 continues the exemption from disclosure as a public record the names and locations of persons engaged in animal research at Oregon Health Science University until January 2nd, 2016.
All right. I'm going to have two panels that are in, let's say, proponents of the bill, and I'm not sure who. I'm going to let Mr. Donovan decide on who the first three will be since these are all tied together. And what I'm going to do is we've got about 35 minutes, or 34 minutes left, so I need you all to take that in consideration so we can get everyone on.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, my name is Phil Donovan, here on behalf of Oregon Health and Science University. First, I just want to say thank you to the chair for the time that you've devoted, both personally and that of the interim committee, to this issue.
I appreciate the accolades, but you have 33 minutes and 35 seconds now.
What I'm here to say is the legislature has played a very important role in ensuring the protection of researchers at OHSU, and we are here today to ask for your continued support of that by not eliminating, but rather extending the sunset to 2016, as Ms. Ross noted. This legislation works. Coming out of the last legislative session, we had an internal discussion about our redaction process, and we also took the time to look at what other possible legislative remedies or options existed that could be utilized to provide researchers protection. Our discussion reinforced that the existing statute is an effective means to both provide protection for those conducting research and ensuring meaningful access to public records. So with me today is Dr. Ilhelm Masoudi, who is going to talk about how important this legislation is to the 500-plus people that work at the Oregon National Primate Research Center. And also on the stand is Janet Billups, General Counsel, who will describe our protocols to ensure that all record requests are treated equally and that all staff that are involved have an accurate understanding of the processes to be followed. So if I could, Mr. Chair, I'll turn it over to Dr. Masoudi.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the Judiciary Committee. Thank you. On behalf of the OHSU community, scientists, and animal caretakers, I want to thank you for hearing Senate Bill 392 today. For the record, my name is Ilhelm Masoudi, and I'm an assistant professor at Oregon Health and Sciences University and at the Oregon National Primate Research Center. My research focuses on understanding why older people are more vulnerable to infection in the hopes that this research will help us develop new vaccines and therapeutics for this population. I want to emphasize to this panel that as scientists, we are not trying to avoid public scrutiny at all. In fact, since most of our research is funded by tax dollars, we have an obligation and a responsibility to inform the public of daily advances that we make in our research. We inform them through publishing our results in scientific journals, going to national, international meetings, as well as through a significant amount of public outreach that we do. And unfortunately, tactics by animal rights extremists, who we define as individuals who use illegal and menacing means to incite violence against scientists, have shifted in the last few years, as documented by the FBI, from targeting institutions to actually targeting individual scientists and their families. And you probably are already aware that some of my colleagues have been targeted in their homes, have had their cars vandalized. Even if even with that information, we know in the last 8 years we have not seen the level of violence, arson, personal violent attacks that we've seen in California. For example, we have handed you some information about a researcher's wife discovering that the brake lines in her cars have been severed. So I can't stress enough how important this law is for my colleagues and their families, and of course myself and my family. We believe that animal extremism can be combated and should be combated in two ways. One, by protecting the scientists whose goal is to improve human health and well-being, and through public discourse. And we believe that this law allows people, individuals, access to records, meaningful access to records, and redacting individuals' names does not preclude that ability, but at the same time offers us the protection that we need. Thank you for supporting this bill.
Thank you. Okay.
Good morning, Chair Przanski, members of the committee. My name is Janet Billups. I'm legal counsel at the Oregon Health and Science University. In 2003, when this bill was initially passed, we were asked by the Senate Judiciary Chair to develop a process that would ensure that the media would not be barred from access to information as a result of this law. We developed that process. And, in fact, it was provided to this committee in the last session. It was called Process to Review and Decide Upon Public Records Requests Subject to HB 3039, which was the original bill number. And that document outlined a different process that's used to handle media versus general public requests. In the last session, we were asked to revisit that process and to revise it in a way that would ensure that all requesters were treated the same, media as well as the general public. And that actually turned out to be a very useful exercise. We went away, we did that since the last session. And what we discovered is that although we had a different process for the media, in fact, all requesters have been treated the same. No one's been treated preferentially, and no one has been picked on. But what we also did in order to conform to your guidance was we updated our policy, and it now reflects that all requests are handled the same way. There's no different process for media or any other request. The only difference is that media requests are handled by the media office. General public requests are generally handled by our public records coordinator. With that in place, I'm going to reiterate, and I'll take 10 seconds to do it, to say that requesters get all of the record, can easily track everything that happens to any animal. The only difference is that the name of the person who provides the specific care, moment by moment, day by day, is redacted. Second thing that I wanted to bring to your attention, that's fairly recent, is the National Association for Biomedical Research is a Washington, D.C.-based organization that advocates for funding as well as policy development for all forms of medical research, and it's a very well-established, well-known, great advocacy organization. It recently published an analysis thank you, Senator. Bill, could you?
Sorry about the problem.
It recently published an analysis, a state-by-state analysis, of states with this purpose in mind. They wanted to identify the states that have the strongest record in supporting medical research through the adoption of researcher protection laws. And in that ranking, Oregon now ranks fifth. We are the fifth strongest, according to this national association, and it is due in large part to the law that is before you today. My final note is that it has sometimes been asked, how can someone keep track of a particular researcher's track record? That process is pretty well known and is very open. Every research institute that has something go wrong, an animal incident go wrong in their science, is required, and we comply with this, of course, is required to report that to a federal agency called the Office of Laboratory Animal Welfare, OLAW. Those records, those reports, have grant numbers on them, are not required to have names, but they do have grant numbers. Any member of the public can get those letters. Once you have a grant number,
you go over to the NIH, which is our primary funding agency. They're very easy to get your way to the website. You plug in the grant number, the name of the principal investigator
comes up. You can then put in the name of that principal investigator, and all that person's grants come up. You take that grant number, those grant numbers, go back to OLAW, and you can then get a copy of all the reports that have ever been filed on animal care incidents with OLAW that relate to that principal investigator. It still divorces the name of the person who, moment by moment, day by day, has provided the specific animal care or committed the error. But it does provide the requester with a means to track what is the track record of the principal investigator who is ultimately responsible for the research. It's very open and easily available in that process. Those are my comments. I'm happy to entertain any questions.
All right, thank you. Questions for anyone on the panel? Thank you very much for coming forward. The last three that I have as proponents on the list, Joe Russell, Jennifer Grissel, and then Gwen Dayton. Udall.
I am. Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Joe Basler. I represent Oregon, the Oregon American Federation of State, County, Municipal Employees. We represent about 24,000 members across the state, but a very small handful of those folks work at the Oregon National Primate Research Center, and we're here to lend our support to this bill and to their safety. For us, this is a worker safety issue. And we want to make sure that not only our folks feel safe, but are safe. Our members there are often the ones who take care of and see to the care of the animals, and they treat them with humanely and with respect. And you know, we want to make sure that that work continues. But that's I brought a member with me, and she knows far more than I do, so I'm going to let her talk.
Thank you.
Good morning, Chair Kuzanski and Senators. My name is Jennifer Greisel. I've worked at the Oregon National Primate Center for about 9 years now. The first 7 years, I started out as an animal husbandry technician, doing daily observations of the animals, making sure they were doing okay, and feeding them and washing their caging. In the time that I've worked there, I always get to know the monkeys that I work with, and I get to know their personalities and their dispositions, and I can always tell when something is off with them, and I make sure to report it promptly to the veterinary staff. When I report it, my name goes into the animal record that I found something wrong with the animal, and so my name is a part of that animal's record. Lots of times the animal rights activists try to portray that the technicians and the animal care staff do not care about the animals, but that's simply not true. We oftentimes have after-work parties to build foraging devices and play structures and trying to find ways to better the lives while they're there at the center.
Jennifer, you have a very soft voice.
Sorry.
I wonder if you could maybe speak up or get maybe a little closer to the mic.
Sorry, yes. So we are all animal lovers, and we care greatly about the animals at the center. The last 2 years have been working for a lab that does thrombosis research, trying to find ways to prevent blood clots and to safely lower platelet counts so you don't have bleeding problems and you also don't get blood clots. There's lots of other cutting-edge research going on at the center, and all of the animal care technicians there are helping to communicate with the investigators to let them know how their animals are doing to make sure that they're getting the research results, the best research results that they can. And it's sad that, the technicians and the staff at the center have to worry about the increasingly violent acts of the animal activists. I ask that you please continue your support of Senate Bill 392. Thank you.
Thank you for coming forward. Really appreciate it. Gwen?
Thank you. Chair Kuzanski, Vice Chair Cruz, members of the committee. I'm Gwen Dayton. I'm General Counsel for the Oregon Medical Association. And I'm here to testify in support of the bill and, frankly, in support of the safety of our physicians who provide services at OHSU and at the Research Center. I think we're here in part because there is a difference of opinion. There are folks who strongly oppose the activities at the Research Center. And one of the most important pieces of information I think you've heard this morning was earlier about the kind of information that is available to people who have a different point of view. I think that's very important, that we're not here today to promote shutting down a public discourse, an honest and public discourse about the merits of research. But that information is available, and as the Supreme Court recently reiterated, the opportunity for expressing one's point of view on this issue is continues to be available. But there is no reason that anyone who disagrees with the activities at the Research Center should have access to information that threatens the safety of those who work there as well as their families. And so I think nobody here is up here at the dais to testifying in opposition to any kind of public discourse, and that opportunity remains. And we need to protect, though, the safety of those who are performing lawful activities that support the safety or the health and safety of Oregonians and people across this nation. So with that, I'll stop and take any questions.
Great. Thank you. Questions? Senator Bonamici?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm sorry I didn't ask this question of the prior panel, but maybe one of you can answer it. Somebody gave us this article about the FBI investigating the Santa Cruz brake tampering case, which is terrible, awful. And it talks about somebody cutting the brake lines on an SUV belonging to a UC Santa Cruz researcher. And it was serious enough to get seven agents of the FBI Terrorism Task Force, which is great. I'm glad it's awful conduct. My question is whether you know if this researcher is more like Dr. Massoudi or more like Jennifer. I mean, who's being targeted? Is it the people who are doing Jennifer's work, or is it the people who are the actual researchers? Sorry.
Yeah, I'm going to let
I thought maybe you could answer, but sorry.
That's quite all right. Just feel good to put your name on the record again, please.
Bill Donovan on behalf of OHSU. Senator Bonamici, the particular incident that you were referring to is a researcher, so more, I believe, in the realm of Dr. Massoudi's background. Obviously, there's concern that those types of attacks would go be extended further. I think what I think is very important to the committee to understand is that it took me about 2 minutes to pull up a website that posted the name of home addresses of California researchers with animal records associated with that. Fortunately, I haven't been able, with my fairly modest internet skills, to find something along those lines here in Oregon. We'd like to keep it that way.
All right, other questions? Thank you very much, Jennifer. I appreciate you coming forward today. Jill, thank you. All right, and let's see. Andrea, come on up. And while she's coming up, is there anyone else who would like to give testimony today on Senate Bill 392?
Chair, members of the committee, Andrea Meyer, legislative director for the ACLU of Oregon, today here again in opposition. I'm sorry, I don't have prepared testimony, written testimony to give you, but I do want to discuss the issue and why we continue to oppose. And I appreciate that the idea is not attempting to stop public discourse, but with all due respect, we still believe it does. I want to reiterate again that ACLU does not oppose the redaction of the home address. But this goes much further by redacting persons' names on government-created public documents. As In Defense of Animals, a lawful 501c3 organization testified 3 years ago, they already can access the names of the researchers with details about their federal grants and their work they're doing. So their identities are already known. Their research work is already known. And, of course, many still have their photo on the website. I checked. I appreciate during the interim committee they testified they have a choice to remove their photos. I would have hoped and expected that they always had that choice. But their description of their projects and all of that is well within access to anyone. We no longer have a media that does investigative reporting, connecting the dots and looking what our government is doing, or we have much less of it than we used to. So it's really left to organizations, lawful organizations, that provide watchdog activities. The ACLU is one of them. We do FOIA requests to the FBI. We uncover violations, and we bring those forward and pursue them. Others do in the areas in which they care about as well. But the only way that you can do this is to connect the information related to the animals to the researchers. Why is it that OHSU wants to keep that information secret? Do they have any evidence that in Oregon, document containing information about the research protocols and the animal treatment led to some activity, criminal activity, directed at that research? I've never heard that link. We always hear about the threats and the criminal activity, and you've got the piece again about some extremely dangerous criminal activity directed at people, but not because of reports on specific animals. However, we do have documentation in Oregon that before this law was passed and existed, that specific information that was accessible was used to bring attention to mistreatment. As was documented in the Willamette Week when they submitted testimony in 2003, they found, Willamette Week did, that almost every request for public records was met with delay and denial. And as they wrote, once they got the records, they understood why, because there were some concerns about the monkeys and how they were being treated. And we learned of the sperm gathering technique called electroejaculation. And that led to publication about it, which resulted in change. Before the law, we learned that Clackamas County Animal Shelter was selling dogs and cats to OHSU to be used for research. If this law had been in effect earlier, it's likely we would never would have known about that, because the names of those who provide goods and services to OHSU researchers were redacted. That type of information, that coverage, is embarrassing. It may affect grants and other resources. It certainly garners publicity, and who would not want to avoid that? But despite the names of the researchers contained in federal documents linked to specific research activities, despite their names being publicized on the web, and despite many still having their photographs, the one solution that OHSU says is the line between their safety and harm is a redaction of public information that can lead to exposure of wrongful treatment of animals and embarrassment. OHSU has argued fear. People are afraid. And I don't doubt that. There are bad people out there. But I'm sorry, using fear is a powerful tool. How do we respond to that? A lot of laws are enacted because of fear, fear that is real and fear that is imagined. But when enacting laws, be it federal level or state, we have to look beyond the argument of fear. And even while accepting the validity, we have to question, is this really the solution? Is there another reason? What other steps are being taken that don't involve making special exemptions to the law? If fear is so prevalent, remove the names entirely. If fear is so prevalent, don't give the researchers the choice of having their photos on the web. Remove them. Protect them. If fear is so profound, choose not to be a public entity subject to the public records request. Law enforcement should be used when threats of criminal activity, but this law has not stopped that and cannot stop it. But somehow it continues to be linked to the harassment that continues. Those who have ill will, those who have criminal intent, are not worried about sifting through these documents, connecting the dots to say that an animal is well-treated or not. To them, all animals mistreated. They don't need the evidence. They will continue to spew, in some cases, lies, for some hatred. But for others, the organizations that take the time to get the information, analyze it, in some cases, the uncomfortable truth. With all due respect, it seems just a little too coincidental that the type of information sought to be redacted is the type of information that's led to abuses. OHSU was delayed for years or denied the documents from watchdog groups. And now I appreciate that after last session, what was clearly an illegal policy that someone from OHSU decided to introduce on the Senate side last year has now been changed. That's only because ACLU exposed it. And year after year, although this is the first year this bill's been heard, that we do not have a record documenting the reports of the requests for records and how they've handled them. So we now no longer have that, which was available, which had shown in the past that PETA and other groups were treated differently because, as I quote from one old document, since this law has been passed by OHSU in their note-taking, they denied the documents to PETA because, quote, in the past, PETA has spread damaging but false information about OHSU animal care. That's fear, but that's fear about free speech. And what they consider false, others may consider truth, but that's what the public records and public discourse is all about. The pattern, we believe, continues. We urge you not to proceed. OHSU is a public agency and cannot pick and choose favorable press versus unfavorable. Individuals can have their home addresses removed for public safety, but they shouldn't be given the authority to remove the names. They keep arguing that the public documents are all available. But why is this piece then so important? And as I pointed out, and as In Defense of Animals testified 2 years ago, because it allows them to link the treatment of the animals and to expose, when appropriate, the researcher's grant proposal, how they're going to treat the animals, and how the animals are treated. If you don't have that link with the researcher's name, you can no longer do that kind of investigative watchdog. That's what happens here. Thank you. Happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Questions? Comments? Thank you.
Keep busy doing work.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Was there anyone else who wanted to give testimony on Senate Bill 392? Not seeing anyone, we'll go ahead and close the public hearing on Senate Bill 392. And colleagues, I believe that takes care of the work that we had for today's agenda. Tomorrow, being Friday, we're not scheduled to meet. We are scheduled to meet on Monday, and I believe we're scheduled to be here at 8:30. And so we're adjourned until then, and have a good day.